Blog Talk Radio.
Our technology is a shit.
Well, you know, I don't blame any fucking computer program that wants to play James Brown twice in a row. I could play that shit for 2 hours straight and just dance. Fuck talking.
Fuck. Dude, fuck language. Language older than words.
Yeah, man. Language is the first oppressive tool of civilization. You know what I'm saying?
Oh,
fuck it. I'm done talking. I'm going to grunt from now on.
We got a great show tonight, dude. I'm really fucking excited for Burn tonight. It's gonna be fucking rad. We got Shante Alston with us. Ah, shit.
Yeah, Shante is an amazing, amazing speaker, an amazing person with a great history, a lot of experience behind him. And you know, that's really the difference between somebody that's just a good speaker and somebody that's really fucking hits you hard is the experience. You know, really living what you're saying. You know, people like Mike Rupert can talk all fucking day, and he sounds great, but you get somebody on here or on anywhere that's really lived what they're talking about, and there's a big difference there, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like, I don't know, like, you know, fuck banks. Fuck them.
Is this your segue? Is that your segue? That's like the best you can get out of a segue. It's like, yeah, you know, language and fuck banks. That's fucking great. You must be learning your segues from like Jimmy Kimmel or something.
Hell yeah. It's all about improvisational thinking.
Yeah, on the fly. Yeah, yeah. What's up with Banks anyway? What do you got against Banks? Tell us. Do you know about the Beastie Boys Bandit?
Yeah, he's some people call him a criminal. I call him awesome.
Yeah, he's pretty fucking rad. For listeners out there who don't know because you don't live in the area, I'm sure it might be getting national attention at this point, but there's a bank robber that's robbing, I believe it's U.S. Bank, right?
Yeah, and as far as I know, he's not hurting anybody.
No, no. I mean, yeah, I mean, I don't even want to qualify those things, even, you know, people that do hurt.
I'm just saying that you can rob a bank without having to hurt anybody.
it's really good. Like, it's something that pacifists can do. You know?
Yeah.
Literally anybody can take part in. And this guy donned a wig and a mustache, and he robs these banks. And, you know, one of the cops was like, well, he looks like one of the Beastie Boys in the Sabotage video. And they're like, that's it, the Beastie Boy Bandit. That makes perfect sense. Yeah. Call the news. Let's put it in the paper. We need the Beastie Boys Bandit. Like, it's fucking ridiculous, but it's awesome because he's robbing these banks. He's getting fucking away with it, you know. And the only criticisms I've heard of this guy from anybody is not really even a criticism. It's just more of a suggestion. It's like U.S. banks. Well, once you rob a Chase bank next, they fuck me over all the time. It's like, oh yeah, well okay, go for that one next. What is it that John Dillinger said when they asked him why he robbed banks? And he said, well, because that's where the money is.
Well, and if you want to talk about I just finished this book, Brave New War by John Robb, who, by the way, accidentally wrote an anarchist handbook. If you look at the concept of systems disruption from the point of view of this bank robber guy, it's one guy. You know, and if you want to look at cost versus return, you know, one guy buys $5 worth of makeup, you know. And is able to walk away, the amount of, you know, economic damage, at least, that he's able to walk away with.
It's
pretty amazing when you're into the handfuls of people, what 2-3 people can do is pretty much like our comrades who climb up trees and fucking are there for days and run off entire corporations. It does happen. It's a fucking tough win, but it does fucking happen. You know, so for all our mass movement people out there, fuck that bullshit.
Yeah, seriously,
a couple
you
of your buddies.
To fit 2 million people into a bank? Come on.
It's not
really
possible. I've done that. By the way, goddammit, cops, thanks for listening. I'm glad that you're being paid to learn about anarchism so I can be charitable. You learn something and get paid. The economy gets better. So thank you. But all this shit is theoretical. We're just, theoretically.
No, fuck that. I'm straight up telling motherfuckers how to do it. Fuck it. Fuck them. Kick down my fucking door, you morons. Right. And I guarantee you, like, I'm not going to be the one when they kick down my door again who's saying, like, you're violating my First Amendment constitutional right. This is against the Constitution. That's always my favorite guy at the fucking protest, the guy with the bullhorn who's at the front of the black block informing the police that they're breaking our constitutional rights. Get the fuck out of here.
I think at that point, I'm pretty sure that document's irrelevant in that context, especially. In every context, though, it's fucking imaginary. It's a goddamn piece of paper a bunch of old dudes fucking wrote some shit on. It's not fucking scripture. Jesus Christ.
You ever try to defend yourself with a piece of paper? You know,
Jesus,
like,
it's impossible. I played paper, rock, scissors, all right? I know the science.
But the Bible says don't kill. You're going to kill me. The Bible says it? Okay, I won't kill you. Gosh. Fucking break. These are murderous pig monsters. Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, seriously. This is fucking... I have a couple of things up here that I'd are pretty good things that... I was looking today at the info shops. Really great shit there today.
Did you hear that, by the way, in the background?
Yeah, what was that?
That was the dude with the biggest penis on my block just drove by, and he proved it with the
nice
muffler. Yeah. I mean, it's Guinness Book. It's science.
I was looking at info shops, but I also wanted to talk a little bit about this. Wendy McElroy at the Freeman Journal wrote this article called Are Cameras the New Guns? I'll I'll throw the link up in chat. But it's interesting.
Bill that passed, right?
What's that?
In reference to the new laws that are passing in many states.
Yeah, those new laws that are passing. And there's also there's a website called Photography is Not a Crime.
We should probably give the background of what the bill is that passed. This passing in all these states, the law.
Yeah, these bills that are being passed are prohibiting the videotaping of police, and they're attaching it in some cases to, like, wiretapping laws and obstructing police. And we're talking things – essentially, there's been a particular spike in media – decentralized media coverage of police violence on the Internet, and especially with Facebook. And what's happening is, you know, we're talking, like, all the random shit. Like, my favorite one's the cop who parks in a handicapped spot at a donut shop. The fat cop, he parks in a handicapped spot. He goes to the donut shop, so, like, he comes out, and the guy's just, like, you know, taping him. And he's like, stop taping me, and there's this thing, and he gets fucked with, and all that's hilarious. But it's all these random things. So what's happening is it's exposing the police, and, you know, their lies are being exposed, and when they fucking lie on their reports, there's more and more video footage. In fact, the Mexican teenager who was recently killed on Mexican soil running from a border cop, initially they said their story's conflicted. Somebody caught on cell phone tape, caught footage of the boy actually being shot by the guy. So what's happening is cops, in response to this phenomenon, are pushing for these laws to be passed to limit, strongly limit. Because what's happening is this media thing. You've got guys who are at the front lines with cameras, and then you've got they've got comrades around who are also taping them. And
yeah, well,
it's interesting. They're really, you know, that's one of the areas of resistance that's happening right now. That for the moment, they seem to be pretty threatened by.
What's great about it? There's a couple things. The first thing is they say that it violates the cops' right to privacy.
Right.
Am I cutting out again?
You've been a little bit, but I can hear you just fine. It sounds basically like your phone starts to lose its signal a little bit, but you know I haven't not been able to understand you. It's not garbled or anything.
It's a fucking CIA.
I know. They're fucking with your signal, dude.
Right. But, so they're saying they're violating the police right to privacy, number one. Number two, every time that you go to any action at all, or anytime you see the police really, really cracking down on people in the streets, there's about one out of every five cops are in the background holding cameras and filming the crowd. And a great piece was documented by Franklin Lopez, the Stimulator, on Submedia TV with Vancouver Media Co-op, where he was filming a march, an anti-police violence march, and he filmed the cop that was filming them. And he was asking the cop, you know, on camera, why are you filming? And the cop was saying, well, you know, I mean, you know, for people that weren't here, so they could see what's going on. And he's like, but what, for what purpose? He's like, well, you know, I mean, just, you know, to see what's going on. Like, why are you filming these people? He's like, well, you know, to see what's happening. You know, so they can see what's happening.
when I saw that.
Surveilling people. They don't even understand the depth of the fucking invasion and intimidation that they cause. They really don't
get
it.
Because the thing is like, you know, I've seen media where the cop very much is very self-aware, very aware that he's being an asshole, and very, you know, and then you'll see those cops who have so taken the, you know, like, are just like swimming in the blue pill, if you will, like where he's just like, yeah, I'm taming people.
I'm just doing. I got a camera, you know, I got a camera here. You press a button. It's what's it called? It's called point and shoot. That's what it's called, point and shoot. Oh,
you have
to focus.
Yeah, that shit's fucking, it's just like, it's just funny, man. It's like, what the fuck?
So, what else is going on? We haven't really been speaking this week, so we don't have any big things to really wrap. But let's talk about the WikiLeaks. I would like to get into this and talk about what it's like to harbor a fucking felon, you know?
So the guy's name is, let me pull up the...
So we don't have to call him WikiLeaks guy all night. WikiLeaks guy.
So the owner, the kind of owner-operator of WikiLeaks has gone missing. The Pentagon is trying to find him.
he's on milk cartons everywhere.
Yeah. So, well, yeah, and it's not, he's more like gone into hiding. It's, you know what I mean? Like, okay, here we go. So the Daily Beast website reports Pentagon investigators have begun searching for Julian Assange. This is from Democracy Now, by the way, guys. The founder of the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks. Earlier this week, it was revealed the website might be in possession of hundreds of thousands of classified State Department cables. And I'm assuming cables means like video, media?
I'm thinking it more means dispatches, like things they send out to their offices, you know, from the main office that gets sent out saying, like, you know, who to surveil and what's going on, like what happened at this thing, what happened here. Just basic communication.
Right.
The kind of shit that you get from the Freedom of Information Act, where it's just like pages full of blacked out shit. This is probably non-blacked out shit.
Well, you know, what's happening is that with this, you know, I'm really on this thing right now. I just finished this guy's book, and so I'm really on this thing right now of some of the effects of media right now in this age that we live in, and it's just kind of interesting to me that how easy it was. Well, I mean, it was you know, relatively easy given the might of, you know, the federal government to get that information, to get it out. It just took a matter of time. You know, and despite the fact that North Korea's got a huge lockdown, information still gets out of there. And so it's interesting to see how threatened they are because, you know, so Rab Rouser and listeners, I'll ask this question. Do you think that police are threatened by this increased, you know, media, decentralized media coverage by the people? Do you think they're threatened by it because... Do you think they feel threatened by that because of simply public opinion just being against them and being embarrassed and alienated? Or do you think they believe that at some point enough of this it will get out that there will be more people fighting them in the streets? Or do you think it's a combination of both?
Let's open the phone line, 646-200-3974. Why the fuck are the cops so fucking scared? That's pretty much the question. Like, are they scared that we're going to violently oppose them, or are they scared because they're going to not be the fucking hero that we talk about all the time? And while we're waiting for callers to call in and talk about this, I want to take this down to a parental level. You know, being a father of two fucking amazing radical kids, and they're at that age right now where they, well, they have been for a few years, where you have to introduce them to social figures, you know what I mean? Like, and they know who firemen are, they know who all these different people are. And when it comes to the issue of police, I get a lot of questions from other radical parents, like, how do you handle teaching your kids about cops? And, you know, my take on it is I let the kids kind of decide. I show them what the cops do. They know who the cops are. They know what the cops do. And let them kind of decide. And it unfailingly, and, it, you know, it's probably because people will say it's biased, but really I feel like I'm just giving them the full information. They honestly fucking can't stand cops. Like, my kids just can't stand the idea of a cop. And, in fact, they use it as an insult all the time. You know, it's like you know, I tell Whitman to do something. He's like, I'm not your slave. Why are you being a cop? It's like people who aren't given the shroud of what the answers are handed to them and are allowed to decipher the information for themselves, even at the young age of 3 years old, can figure out what's right and what's wrong. It's pretty fucking easy to do. And when you see these people patrolling around the neighborhoods, putting people, you know, they put people in fear, and the kids see this. The kids see the fear that gets put in there. The kids see the cops coming and harassing us at our house. The kids see, you know, they see their dad coming back from protests, and they can't give me a hug because I'm covered in fucking pepper spray and chemicals. And, you know, that's always the first question when I get back in is, you know, number one, they're really excited I'm alive and not in jail. And number two is always like, did you get hit with chemicals? You know, they want to make sure they can give me a hug first before I have to strip down naked and fucking burn my clothes. And, you know, these kids can decide on their own. So, but the interesting thing about that is if you think about it, like, I know kids who don't live in radical houses, who haven't had radical upbringings. And think about how many times in our lives we were told that the cops were good guys. And how many times we're told daily, and look at the people that still buy into this shit, that these cops are risking their lives for our freedom and all of this bullshit. Like, really think about it. Like, think about how much, it, you know, it's like Daniel Quinn says, you'll hear it so much that it's not even there. you know, you won't even be able to decipher what mother culture is telling us, because it'll be so quietly in the background of every single thing that we do that it just becomes part of our accepted daily life.
Well, I got into a conversation on my break the other day with a few regular customers. We were sitting outside, and we were talking about the Red and Black Cafe's stance against police violence by throwing a cop out of their cafe and the maelstrom of that. And we were talking. We of course, got onto the whole notion of cops. And instantly folks go into this thing where we started talking about the kid who was shot 25 times. And, I mean, I was just, really, really shocked. And I was just like, look, dude, this kid was shot 25 times. He had bullet holes in his hands. That means his hands were over his face. This guy was like, oh, well, he got out of his car and started shooting and said he shouldn't have done that. And then, first of all, that's bullshit. The kid didn't get out of his fucking car.
No, he was taken out of his car after he was shot 23 times. They dragged him out of his
exactly.
car and beanbagged him 8 times and left his body sitting uncovered for 6 hours on the side of the road.
Yeah, and you know, when I told him, I said, look, you know, let's look at, in the first place, why he was stopped. He was stopped because he was a black kid in a hoodie. You know, that's why he was stopped, and because he looked like he didn't belong. And the response I got was this kind of, dude, he had a fucking gun. I'm like, cops have fucking guns.
Right.
I mean, if the Russian mafia is fucking running
fucking
around in the...
Your uncle fucking Bill has a fucking gun, you know?
I mean, it's just this resistance to this idea that, in point in fact, this... is a dysfunctional, not virtuous institution that we're so doggedly supporting, and you know, this kind of furrowing of the brow, this kind of angry resistance to it, is something akin to, sobering up. You know, it's this kind of like, fuck that, and then you take more drinks, you pound more drinks, man. You know, like, starting to sober up, this sucks, and pound more drinks, and fucking leave the conversation. It's fucking tough to get through, especially when it's just like, dude, he was a kid. He was shot over 20 times. 20 times. You know, and the sociopathic nature of this culture, the fact that we're so easily able to, I mean, that's in our backyard. That's right here in Portland. You know, that happened here.
Happened on my bus route to work. Yeah.
Right. A girl I know lives near there and works near there and saw the cops running and shooting their guns. It's fucking crazy, man. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, the craziest thing to me is I guess the way that we still have such a long battle ahead. You know, it's this fight for equality or fight for acceptance within an institution whose sole purpose it is to fucking destroy you. It's to keep you enslaved. It's to keep you fucking, you know, subservient. It's to keep you scared. And we're people, social justice activists, are fighting for exactly that, social justice. They want to be justified socially in the things that they're fighting for. They want it to be okay for them to say things that are a little bit dangerous. And it's like, you know, I'm not fighting for acceptance of my ideas. I don't ever expect, you know, mainstream society or even a large part of the non-mainstream alternative society to accept the fact that I'm fighting for these things. I don't think it's going to happen. I don't expect it. And, you know, to be honest, I don't even think I want it. I've seen too many movements fall under recuperation, you know, where the state sees the damages and sees an ability to come in and subvert it and control it and own it. I mean, look at the civil rights movement. It's seen as this huge victory for, you know, black Americans. And really, I mean, let's look at what we still have. I mean, we still have the largest percentage of black males in prison. We still have, black families being evicted on a daily basis. We still have gentrification taking place. We still have violence against black people in this country committed by police and the state. We have all of these things, and there's no movement anymore because it's been recuperated. They tell you they give you a victory, and it's like, you know, it's like food stamps. You know, I'm on food stamps. My family gets food stamps because we have to be able to survive. I have no scruples about that. Yeah, I'm an anarchist, and I fucking hate the state. But I have no scruples about taking whatever fucking food or anything we can get from it in the meantime. And some people give shit to that. Like, well, if you're opposed to the state, why do you get food stamps? And it's like, because they are fucking thieves and they are murderers. And I can't live in this fucking society without getting back from them what little I can, but it doesn't silence me. And that's the thing. It's like, you know, it's such a silencing tool. People are like, well, you know, if we better keep our mouths shut, otherwise they're going to crack down on us, you know. Well, if the state goes, your food stamps will go. Then what do you do? And then, if the state goes, 98% of our fucking problems go. You know? Like, the inherent inequality and violent fucking monopoly that the state holds over our heads is gone.
And then there was this fucking video I saw recently where before Barack Obama won the presidency. It was in his senatorial days. And it's this clip of him talking. He's arguing against privatization of military, right? Like hiring contractors and that kind of shit, right? And he's all, see, what you're doing is you're essentially privatizing what you're doing is your, essentially, I can't do fucking Barack Obama impersonation. Anyway, hello?
I can do Barack Obama.
He's saying that you're essentially privatizing something that and then he pauses and he's like, well, what a nation state is a monopoly on violence. So you may do that, impersonate Barack Obama saying that the nation state is a monopoly on violence.
Yeah, he thinks that's a good thing, you know. Yeah.
Right. No, I asked you to... Do your impression of the president saying that.
You want me to try that?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll try it. What we have here is we have a nation state, essentially, a monopoly on violence. And that cannot be breached. So, to conclude, what we're discussing here today is the privatization of violent forces that wish to strip away the monopoly of the violence that the state has.
Nice.
It's not bad. It's not that good, actually.
No, it's pretty good. No, it was really nice.
It's better.
Okay, so you know, we're going to be taking our break here in the next 20 minutes, and I wanted to, if we can, I want to talk about some of the underreported struggles going on from around the world. There's a lot of shit. I was just flipping through on InfoShop News. I was thinking maybe Rabble Rouser, I could just kind of read some of these off and just cut me off or interrupt it when you want to fucking trip out about any of these, because there's a...
Okay. I'm just going to throw some shit out there. You just snap it whichever one you want.
All right. So we got 50,000 protests against Arizona's anti-immigration law. Hundreds gather in northern B.C. against Enbridge oil tanker plan. Eagle Rock Defenders Camp crushed, quote unquote, by police. Have you read about this?
No. Right, Eagle Rock. Where is? Update me on that. Where is that? I've heard that name.
Dozens of heavily armed police and state troopers have raided the peaceful defenders camp at Eagle Rock in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, quote, crushing the month-long effort to protect the site from a controversial sulfide mine. Immediately following the raid, the mining company. Kennecott, and everybody that's K-E-N-N-E-C-O-T-T, Kennecott, swiftly moved in, demolished the camp, and set up a fence around Eagle Rock. Fuck.
Huh. There's no connection there between the state and the corporations?
No, none whatsoever. That's the free market right there, fucking assholes.
They're protecting our fucking liberty, you know?
That's not a free anything. You know,
question. Here's my question. Wait, before we move on real quick, I want to get this out. If the police went to raid the Eagle Rock dissenters' protest and they acted as if the people on the flotilla acted, and they violently resisted, and they used sticks, they used whatever was at their disposal, they may have been crushed. Now, what if those protesters had heavily armed guards who were surrounding the protest, guarding them from the vicious state? Yeah, you know, what would we see? What would we see happen in these cases? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean,
If this happened in Thailand, you and I would be talking about it in a whole different context. Well, maybe not now, but in the past, think about it. We fetishize resistance outside of the U.S. We just do. We fetishize it. It's a good thing. It's always a good thing. The dude with the cannon, you know, firing the cannon, the Chinese farmer firing the cannon to keep off the... Now, if a farmer did that here, we'd probably, first of all, write him off as a right-wing fucking nutcase, right? I mean, that would be the first thing everybody would come to mind. Joe Stack, he must be a right-wing nutcase, right? Obviously. Well, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, what's the difference?
You mean the difference between the people fighting on the flotilla and the people in Michigan?
Yeah.
And there is no difference. I think that's just it. That's been kind of, because I've been absolutely guilty of fetishizing resistance abroad and then being condemning of it here when it happens. And I think that's in part because, obviously there's some sense of nationalism that infects me, and that's my shit to work through. But there is no fucking difference. And I think that, the flotilla's plan to not have weapons is strategic, because I think ultimately with enough media, there's some video that's been released by culturesofresistance.org has released this raw footage of people inside the boat while shit was going on, I think up top or something like that. And it's really scary. And, I think that, had the people at E-Rock had guns, how would it have played out? How would the media have covered it? How would it, if they would have covered it? Because they haven't. I didn't hear about this shit until today, so I read this just now. Had they had guns, would it have got on the TV? Fuck yeah, it would have.
I don't know. Here's the thing. It's like...
It would be painted as a fucking terrorist,
on a daily basis, Groups take up arms all over the world on a daily basis. There are... I would probably venture to say there are no less than 100 violent guerrilla groups out there today all over the world who are fighting against, the corporate takeover or the state takeover of their land. I mean, in Brazil alone and in the Amazon jungle, all over the Amazon, there's indigenous peoples who have taken up arms. And it might get a little bit of news on the 14th page, but the first page is going to be, some sports bullshit, some fucking, dog fighting fucking, cock male oppressing fucking football player gets on the front page. But it might get page 14, but it's not going to be discussed in the consciousness of America. It's just not, but it happens all the time. So I don't know. I think here's the thing, is I think that represents the tipping point, and that if those things get coverage at all, it's going to be slanted, obviously, but even if it's slanted, it still covers that things exist. Just like when a massive amount of anarchist protests that I see happening don't get any fucking headlines at all anywhere. They really try to silence that dissent because it's people know that it's time. It's awakening in the culture. We are building a small culture of resistance. It's really small right now, but it's happening. I mean, people are becoming more and more aware of these things. You could see it in the bumper sticker rhetoric. It's out there.
And I think one of the things that we're realizing is that you can do a lot with a small. We're starting to move away from this large. Globalization is ending globalization, so to speak, and I think that one of the things we're realizing in the radical community is that there's a lot that can be done, starting with ourselves and with others, and whether it's direct action or it's counter-institutional or economical or a blend or something. We're realizing that we have quite a bit of potential right at our fingertips, beginning with ourselves, and I think that. With the open source information sharing that we're doing, we're developing these, this almost kind of a huge decentralized network that we've never, really had before, and it's an exciting time. But I think that part of growing within that community is realizing that, I'm speaking for myself, is realizing that while there's the things that I want to do and I'm into happen to be nonviolent for sure, and if I were different. Position, but would I choose differently? I don't even go there. I can only count on how I am now. And what I've had to learn is that, it's a fucking really, it's a really big fight. And they know that. And you know, I was looking at some photographs this week of graffiti resistance, and you know, one was just says we're winning, you know, we are winning with the A as the anarchist symbol, and I'm just like, you know, I really think that too. I think despite it all, it's just it's becoming one of those that whole thing where the state as it is constructed is becoming unable to deal with this decentralized resistance. And I think, you know, now, I mean, I know it's always common for generations to always say, you know, now it's different and now it's different, but I'm going to fucking say it. I think the time we're living in, whether we'll see anything really change in our lifetimes, you know, whatever, that's not really, that shouldn't really be the point. The fact is that we're fighting and that we have some tools now that could make it, we really have the potential to fucking, the good guys could win.
Right.
You know, like we have some real potential.
Here's something I want to address with that, too. I was on I called into another radio show, and I was on the chat room of another anarchist program on Blog Talk Radio. There is more than one anarchist program on Blog Talk Radio, by the way, called the Authority Smashing Hour. And it's a good program. You know, it's more academic in setting. But I was saying, you know, they were kind of pronouncing nonviolence as being the only way and, you know, all this stuff. And I was like, well, you know, why do we always fucking discount violence? Why? Why? We need to really fucking inspect this. And they're like, well, why are you always so dogmatically violent? And I'm like, well, number one, I've never talked to you before, so I'm not. number two, like, when I do mention violence, it's fucking shut down quicker than shit. And here's the problem. It's like, he said to me, well, what about a radio show? Isn't that nonviolent? Why even bother? And here's the fucking thing. Number one, a radio show, a media outlet, any of that shit is not revolutionary action. It's not fucking an act of war. It's just not. It's information, which is awesome. But information is not the end all. It's the means to a beginning. It's not a means to an end. We could share information all fucking day. We could sit here and we could talk about this, and we do, and we love it, and we get off on it. And there's people that get turned on to it every day, and that's fucking great. But this isn't all we should be doing. You know?
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
And to think that your fucking radio show is a revolutionary act is symptomatic. It shows me how fucking crazy this society is and how white privilege really does affect us. We think that because we have a fucking radio show that we're going to change things. Yeah, you know, that's it. Oh, by the way, I've decided, and I've come to this conclusion, and now you will.
Because yeah, I mean, it's the weird digital internet culture that it's a double-edged sword because on the one hand, it allows us, you know, like for myself, and I've been able to get connected to some really amazing people, amazing thinkers, and amazing fighters, and all these great things.
Most
on the other hand,
FBI wanted list.
Right.
Wah, 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 wah.
But then on the other hand, there's that cult-like, you know, thing in forums where, you know, it's like I've had to stop reading comments on things like YouTube and videos. I've had to stop reading the comments on, like, when the local news covers, you know, police violence and it's really slanted and, you know, there's anarchist action and it's this biased review. I can't read the comments. I have to stay away from them because they will fuck with my brain. You know, my comment, I love media and I'm an information whore. I'm absolutely open to that. But I think it's a real mistake to assume that anything is really better. I think that's relative. I think what we're talking about, I mean, this is Burn. Burn is a show where we talk about resistance and resisting and how people have resisted, the ways in which you can resist, and understand that it is only through, in my opinion, through allowing ourselves to accept others within the resistance and understand that we don't have the moral ground look, when someone lets off a fucking car bomb in front of a fucking cafe and kills a bunch of babies, yeah, fuck that fucking barbarian, okay? Fuck that fucking asshole. I do have the moral fucking grounds to say fuck that fucking asshole. I feel that I do. Fuck that guy. But when you're talking about something like sitting in a fucking tree, you know, protecting a fucking forest, the shit that helps us breathe from fucking machinery that's going to fucking, you know, like, and throwing rocks at fucking dudes, you're not, you know, like, you know,
Hold on, wait a second. you're saying that you have the moral high ground to say fuck that barbarian that like the suicide bomber or the car bomber that kills people in a cafe. Here's the thing. The setting in which we live isn't catered to those ideas at all. We aren't in that position right now. But I mean, can you honestly say that you have a moral high ground over a kid who grew up in occupied Palestine who's seen his whole family get dragged out of his house and beaten and disappeared, and his house gets bulldozed, and now it's happening to his neighbors and his neighbors' neighbors, and it just keeps happening, and he, like, you know, he's invisible in the media, he's invisible in the fucking public eye in any way, and he finds it somehow effective to do this. Now, here's the thing is, I don't necessarily condone that activity, but I'm not going to say I have a moral high ground to say that kid's fucked for what he did. I mean, you know, look at this. Look at what it is. It is a violent reaction to the state and the way that it acts. And, you know,
sure, dude, but personal response, you know, but I'm all with you there, dude. But fucking, you know, personal responsibility is fucking personal responsibility. And, look, I get that, this culture makes us fucking crazy. You know, I agree with that. But personal responsibility is a real thing. There are fucking thousands and thousands of people in Iraq who've seen all the same fucking shit that guy has, and they don't do those things because they fucking aren't fucking barbarians. Some people are fucking barbarians, whether they're in fucking our rich fucking society. Let me finish. Some people, whether they're in our society or they're there, are going to do shit that, in my fucking opinion, is fucking completely barbaric. And it's not about effectiveness. It's about fuck you, that's fucking just mass murder. And look, this shit happens, and it's to be expected, and it's completely predictable, and it is a symptom of civilization and all of those things. It is those things. But to fucking say the devil made him do it, fuck that shit. That person made a conscious choice to do something. So yeah, since I am also, let me finish, since I am also affected by this culture, I could just as easily snap one day and go fucking blow someone away. But I fucking work really hard to keep it together. And I think people around the world who see way worse shit than I have and keep it together, I think they do so out of a fucking sense of personal responsibility. And I think we have to be really careful about going the whole fucking devil made me do it.
I'm not going with the devil made me do it.
I kind of think you are in this case.
But I'm not. What I'm saying is we don't have
yes,
any
you are.
To take a moral high ground of any sort to judge anybody else's actions in that context.
I'm not like judging his soul, dude. I'm just saying, fuck that.
Let me talk. What we all right,
sorry, my bad.
We have a charge in front of us to make us act even stronger to put an end to the situation that creates that.
Totally.
I completely agree with you.
Somebody
a fucking barbarian. I wouldn't call.
Fuck yeah, it is. Fuck that asshole. And you know, and fuck the soldier who guns down fucking kids running away from a fucking car bomb. Fuck that fucking barbarian too. Fuck him. He believes he's there doing the right thing. He was raised in this culture and he was told that you have to obey authority and you have to do those things. He's gone ahead and done all that shit. Fuck that fucking asshole too. He's a fucking barbarian. These are fucking monsters, but they're self-aware monsters. They know what they're doing. They're making these decisions. So fuck them, man. Yeah, I haven't made any decisions as of yet to fucking kill some kid. I haven't made that decision. I haven't been in a place where I've had to make that choice. But I would really, really like to think, and I really believe that ultimately I wouldn't fucking do it. And I believe that most people ultimately wouldn't do that. And those who will, fuck them, man. Fuck them. So yeah.
I guess I don't decipher too much difference between the state and those who profit from it and those who live in the comforts of it happily. And you know, I just don't. I can't accept that there's good Germans out there that, you know, I just can't accept that. And I'm not talking about
good Germans, dude. I don't fucking...
No, but listen, you are. When you're talking specifically about, let's say, a car bomb in Israel, you're talking about people who are, for the most part, accepting of, at least, and probably, I'm going to assume, happy with their position in Israel, which is sitting on the fucking necks and throats of the Palestinians, and they're living their daily lives accepting of this, and they're not fighting back, and then this act happens
that brings it to their fucking doorstep. And it sucks that people have to die. But think about that. Think about Nat Turner going into the home of the slave owners and slitting the throats of everybody in that house. It's a fucking vicious act. But guess what? Those fucking slave owners lived on the fucking throats of Nat Turner and his family and all of his friends for fucking years. And
totally, but dude, what you broke, and you know, but dude, but what I'm talking about is a guy pulls up in a fucking car and blows up a place full of people that aren't connected to him in any way, shape, or form. You know, and what we're talking about is a soldier fucking gunning down kids who have nothing to do with some bomb that went off. What we're talking about are specific acts that are inherently fucking psychotic, as opposed to acts that while are fucking vicious and crazy, have more of a logic to them. Like that guy doing that, you have a direct connection. And it's still crazy, and I'm just like, whoa, that's fucked up, dude. You did a bunch of fucked up shit. But and I'm not arguing that the violence that these people are surrounded by, including the soldiers from America and including these fucking kids in Iraq, isn't horrible, and it doesn't have – I'm not denying any of that, man. But what I am saying is that when someone pulls up – when someone fucking blows up a bunch of children for their fucking cause, that's fucking butchery. And whether it's fucking – of course it's understandable. Of course it's a fucking symbol. Of course all that. But I think that when we start going, well, I don't want to condone or condemn. No, some shit we got to fucking condemn. Take a goddamn stand. If we're going to be fucking opposed to poisoning the fucking oceans, and we're going to be opposed to clear-cutting our fucking forests, and we're going to be opposed to killing animals, then we have to be opposed to killing fucking babies in a coffee shop and not fucking go, oh, well, he's civilization. Yeah, we're all fucked up. But some shit we got to take a fucking stand and say, no, fuck that. I draw a line.
Look, am I saying would I strap on a fucking vest right now full of dynamite and go out of fuck? No, I wouldn't. But I'm not in that fucking position. I haven't seen my fucking family dragged out of our home, beaten and fucking killed in front of me. I haven't seen my school get fucking occupied when I was 7 years old and told that I can't fucking move an inch or I'm going to get a fucking bullet through my head. I haven't experienced that. And so what I'm saying is, because of that, I am in no position to take a moral stance on this. I can say, oh man, that's a horrible thing that happened. But I'm not going to say.
But dude, you can take a. But I don't understand.
I'm not going to say that fucking barbarian that did that. I'm going to say, that's a fucking horrible situation, period. And we have to fight to make sure that shit doesn't happen that way. And it's not about taking out the fucking barbarians, Travis. It's about fighting against the situation that allows for that to happen.
But how can you end this? Then you're talking out of both sides of your mouth. Because then you have, if you're going to use that logic in defense of those people and be so forgiving, then you have to in turn be that forgiving for fucking cops. Because you can make the exact same argument. And I'm saying fuck that. I'm saying fuck that. They're fucking responsible for what they choose to do. They have to be held accountable. We all do.
Travis, you can't see the difference between a kid who's – look, the only difference between a suicide bomber and a resistance fighter, a soldier of any sort in any war is the suicide bomber dies. The other guy gets to live to kill tomorrow. This is the thing. There is a fucking difference between a kid who's a suicide bomber. I'm not saying it's a good thing to be that, but there's a difference between that and a fucking cop, and you know there is, because that fucking cop is oppressing people for his own fucking
comfort. But that fucking cop, dude, he's a member of this culture. He's been influenced by all this teaching. Yeah, you have to, because if you're going to give a shit all the time.
Nobody has to die. No, nobody's wrong. Nobody has to die. It's fucking CEO.
No, that's not what I'm fucking saying. But
no,
this whole fucking thing is based on religious fundamentalism. People pull up and they fucking kill babies. And the fact that you can offer any kind of forgiving voice for that is fucking bullshit and hypocritical.
Are we talking about Palestine and Israel? That's not fucking religious fundamentalism. Give me a fucking break.
Dude, that shit happens. Although that's fucking a huge part of it, man. And to deny that is fucking. Dude, that's fucking a huge part of what's going on and has been going on in that part of the world for a really long time. It's fucking holy wars and shit.
You really buy that?
Dude, of course that's part of it, dude. That shit happens all over. That's not unique to the Middle East. That's in America. That's in Canada. That's in Europe. That shit happens all over. It's political,
you know,
too.
You know
that's fucking
public relations. You know that that's public relations.
No, Michael, it is religion. It is politics. It's money. It's drugs. It's all of those things.
What is religion? When you control people with a religion, you are using it to control
their people. Sure. Fine.
So
it's religion. It's politics. It's business.
It goes logically to say that if you...
if you say that you're doing a religious fundamentalist war, that's what it is. It's about a religion. People are going to buy it, but that's not what it is. This is a fucking
war. But I'm not saying that, dude. You're not hearing me. I'm saying that's part of it. There's religion. There's politics. There's fighting against business. There's fighting against fucking invaders. All of that shit is present. But I want to come back around to this whole thing. Ultimately, what I'm being critical of is that there are thousands and thousands of other human beings, individuals in those lands who have seen all that horrible shit too and choose to figure out other ways to survive and other ways to do that that don't involve fucking killing babies. And those are the people that I think we should emulate. Those are the examples. And I think that we should condemn that shit.
Number one, what are you talking about? You're acting like they're targeting fucking preschoolers.
They're not. See, that's the thing. It's not a matter of, like, I'm going to go kill some babies now. But they know that I'm going to pull up this car in front of a fucking coffee shop, and it's going to explode. And they know that there's going to be fucking babies and children and fucking people shopping. They know that that shit's going to be there, and they make that decision knowing that information. And if they don't know that information and they've been tricked into doing that, then it's so fucking horrible, and the fucking people who triggered it, you know, I mean, so fuck that. We can't fucking be forgiving of that kind of shit, despite the fact that it's fucking fucked up and we know what's going to happen. We need to change the fundamental psychology that, you're exactly right, and I agree with you, that produces that in the first place. But also,
it's
we have to change something deeper about ourselves
not,
and how
I'm
we
not,
deal with fucking...
I'm not making a fucking martyr out of this kid, and I'm not saying he's a fucking hero.
I know you're not. I know you're not.
What I'm saying, Travis, is that to completely condemn him, call him a barbarian, is to discount and disclude all of his reasons for doing what he did. He did it because he's a barbarian. That's why he did it. No. Bullshit. He did it because the fucking social situations that surround what he did, the way he fucking was forced to live, eating the shit off of the fucking boots of the monsters who patrol his fucking neighborhood, forced him into the position where that was the only way he felt he could fight back. So, no, it's not. I'm not going to disclude that. I'm not going to call him a barbarian. I'm not.
Okay, well, I will call that person a fucking sizable scale murderer, and I will call that person, because that's what the fucking act is.
Murderer, no doubt.
And if you don't want to call it barbarian, then fine. I apologize for using barbarian. It's a barbaric act.
You can call him a barbarian all day. You can call him whatever you want.
But no, you have a valid point. No, you have a valid point, and I want to let everyone else know that that is a valid point, and that is, you know, maybe not the most appropriate word that I could use.
And what this all comes down
to... I do want to go on record and say I was calling lots of people barbarians, I think, over the past...
What this comes down to right now is that I win. I win.
Because ultimately, listeners, this is all about winning arguments to our 10 listeners on our fucking shitty radio show. So we are at the 6:52 mark. So let's go ahead. Why don't we go ahead and take our break? We can cool off and maybe masturbate. I got a really killer clip I want to play for you guys. The title is A Little Ambitious. You can look it up on the YouTube. It's called The Most Powerful Video You'll Ever See. Yul is spelled U-L-L. Ooh. But it's actually pretty cool. About halfway through, you'll hear a guy shouting to a crowd. Yeah, that's a WWF wrestler, and you'll love what he's shouting. So, is that cool, Rob Rousing? You want to take a break?
Yeah, sounds good.
And we'll come back with our awesome guest,
Sean
Dale. By
the way, Max Parthas is saying that this shit is not productive, that our arguments are not productive. He could argue his own self. No need to hear it here. We all have opinions. Let's get some answers and make some plans. Here's the problem, Max. Here's the problem. We don't have answers. If you think that somebody's going to give you an answer for the situation that you're facing, that's the fucking problem. You're not going to get those answers. The idea is to hear all the sides that we can, to work through the fucking demons that we have inside of us, figure the shit out, and come up with our own solutions. And that's what this is about. It's not about telling people how to live their lives or how to fight the fight. It's just not about that, because it's not going to work that way. It doesn't work that way. If you have a man that has an answer, you have a man that has an agenda, and I wouldn't recommend working with him. If you have somebody that wants to fight for the opening of the possibilities, I would recommend standing beside that person all day.
Cool. So, all right.
Well, yeah, we're going to
take a 10-minute break, and... Yeah, we'll be back with Shante. Thanks for tuning in. Stay with us.
the top 10 right too.
He had turned to Islamist extremism, and therefore...
I personally believe that U.S. Americans are unable...
Police department! Forward police department, your house is on fire! We got the fire department en route. Ma'am, you need to come out now.
The one that's on fire is over here.
He kicked the door in on the wrong house.
Brother, the floor is yours.
I'd like to take this moment to talk about something very serious right now. So if you'll please allow me to take this off so you can lose any preconceived notions you might have of me by looking at me and listening to my words. What I would like to talk about tonight is the war in Iraq. Now wait a minute. I remember something, that's right. May 3rd, 2003. George Bush lands on the USS Lincoln and announces an end to the war. Big red, white, and blue banner. Mission accomplished. But here we stand, more than 6 years later. And if we're no longer at war, then somebody tell me what is killing hundreds of my brothers and sisters every day. Innocent women, innocent children. This is a world you people know nothing about.
But here's the bottom line. You need to go out and you need to look with your own eyes what's going on. The business is closing around you, the empty storefronts, the empty homes, the demolished homes, the number of homeless out there. It's a very scary situation. The hallmark of a fascist economy is that profits are kept private. If you make a lot of money, you're willing to share a little bit of it with politicians, you get to keep it. Losses are socialized. That's what all these bailouts are all about, all the TARP, all these other little acronyms they're using. They're basically taking all the bad deals that Wall Street and the banks and the investment companies and the real estate companies, all those bad deals they made, they're dumping them on you, the American taxpayer, and they're driving you into poverty doing it. They're keeping the goodies for themselves. Bonuses, huge amounts of money. They're having a really, really good time, and they're making you pay for it. They're forcing you to buy the bad assets from the banks and mortgage companies collectively. It's all about taking money from the poor and giving it to the rich. That's what they're doing right now. And it's going to start coming apart because the only way they can keep it going is they're printing up the money. Somewhere down the road, you, your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren are going to suffer a lifetime of indebted servitude to pay it all back. That's the plan. That's what allows them to sort of do bookkeeping tricks to say they're not really inflating the money supply because it's a loan on behalf of the people. And you're seeing it at the supermarket and at the gas pump because here's the bottom line. We gave our manufacturing away. We gave our agriculture away. We used to be the breadbasket to the world. We grew so much food we could waste half of it and still have tons and tons to sell to other countries. We don't do that anymore. Now they're trying to carbon tax you for global warming. It's one scam after the other, after the other, after the other. And the question I have is, why are you not furious? Why are you not angry? How many more lies must you be told to understand the reality of life in the United States of America? How many of your sons and daughters and brothers and sisters and husbands and wives have to come back in those cheap aluminum boxes covered with a cheap American flag made in China before you realize the true nature of life in the United States of America? How many more photographs of American soldiers guarding and protecting opium poppy fields in Afghanistan you have to see before you understand the true nature of life in the United States of America? There has to be a breaking point somewhere. Frankly, I thought we would have hit it before now. Where's the breaking point? Are they putting tranquilizers in the water? I don't know. There's a lot of medical stuff in the water. That's been confirmed. There are our society is so drugged out with pharmaceuticals that we're being sold. After decades of debate on fluoridation of water, finally, firmly established scientifically, that fluoride does not inhibit tooth decay in any way at all. It never did. So why is it in the water? Well, it calms people down. It suppresses anger and rage. Is that why it's in the water? I don't know. If you look around at the state our country is in, and you have to wonder, where is that righteous anger that freed this nation from British rule? Where did it go? Has it been bred out of us? Have we been subject to some vast breeding experiment to basically turn us from being real human beings into some sort of a semi-human primate usable for forced labor and military conquest and really not capable of much else? Have we been devolved instead of evolved? Are we being devolved to this sort of subhuman creature that can't feel anger or rage at our enslavement, that gladly offers our throat or our wrist up to the butcher's knife on demand? It's rather alarming.
The whole conspiracy is founded on keeping humanity in a very, very low level of perception, perception about self, perception about the world. This is why we have the dumbing down of education. This is why we have the controlled so-called information that comes through the media. The idea is to keep people in ignorance of anything that would be a problem to the control system. So we're kept in ignorance about the nature of reality itself, the nature of life itself, who we are, where we are, what we're doing here. We're kept in ignorance of the true forces that are manipulating behind the people we see in the public arena. Now, all these connections have to be kept from people so that we behave and perceive the world and everything in the way that suits the control system. So any awakening, any opening of the mind to see things that people didn't see before is a real big problem for the conspiracy, for the manipulators. And what we're seeing now, as more and more people are awakening, is a almost panic-stricken attempt to put the lid on this, to dumb people down. And this is one reason why we're seeing the ever greater drugging of American children, not just American children, but in the wider world too. While we're seeing more and more of these chemical cocktails in food that destabilize the body's chemical balance. And all of these things fundamentally affect the way people see the world and their ability to think sharply, to think straight, to see what's actually going on. They want us here. And what an awakening mind does is start to do this. And when you do that, you start to connect dots that you can't actually see here. And so we're at this fork in the road where people have to choose. Are they going to go on being controlled sheep and robots of the control system, or are they going to wake up and take the road to freedom? That's the fork in the road, and that's the choice that people are facing now and will face ever more blatantly in the next few years.
You people are brainwashed by the American media. You're brainwashed to believe that voting for an American idol is more important than voting for an American president. You're brainwashed to believe that a dead king of pop deserves the front page of the newspaper more so than a dead Iraqi child. You people are brainwashed because for the weak, it's easier than the truth. And the truth is, you people don't want our land. You people don't want to install democracy. You people don't even want to stop terrorism. The truth is, you, America, are a junkie.
The existentialist philosophers talk about the execution of victim relationship that is always prevalent in most of the world today, especially the non-white world, where they're fighting for their liberation. He says there are executioners and there are victims. The executioners are self-imposed. The victims begin to fight and agitate for their liberation. They use all type of means. to get their liberation. The revolutionary philosopher Frantz Fanon says that what happens is that the victim begins to agitate. He uses all types of means against his executioner in fighting for a position of equality. After he tries a number of means and they do not work, he then begins to imitate the means by which his executioner has him down. That is usually through force and violence. He says, and then they begin to use it against them, breaking the one taboo that they've never been able to break, hitting back against their executioners, so that you ought not to be upset if we are violent. The United States taught us very well how to be violent.
One of the greatest radical speakers of his time, no doubt. And we're on the other end now with Ashanti Alston.
Hey, power to the people, to you and the audience.
All power to the people. You want to start us off? Give us your start off, man. Give us the warm up that you like to give, because it really does pull the listener in. Maybe we can get our listeners at home to speak aloud in their living rooms or open their windows and shout it out. Start us off.
Well, listen, I just want to say thank you for inviting me to be on your program. I want all them out there listening to know that as a former member of the Black Panther Party, soldier of the Black Liberation Army, political prisoner of war for a total of 14 years, I am still optimistic that we can make this revolution happen. And I want people to know all the stuff that we've been through, and even those political prisoners who've been in there 30, 36, 39 years are still optimistic. We are living at a time where we need revolution more than anything else. And I do want to say, as an anarchist, you know, we have a big role to play now, and we can step up. We can step up with some confidence, because I think that we've already began to shape things even since like the Seattle battle and stuff. So I'm looking forward to this time here. The 60s is over.
Right on. So let's give an introduction here. You gave yourself an introduction a brief introduction of the time you spent and the groups that you worked with. But I want to give an introduction to how I was introduced to you. You write a zine periodically called The Anarchist Panther. And I picked this up, and I was spellbound, because here's the thing: is I always had a lot of respect and a lot of love for the Black Panther Party. I mean, Fred Hampton is definitely a person that I think I tell my children about now. Huey Newton, the whole movement, the things the Black Panthers did, and I want you to talk about that in a little bit. But I always knew that there was an ideological split there between the somewhat Maoist stances of the Black Panther Party and my anarchist philosophies. And then I found
right.
The Anarchist Panther, and I want you to talk about that. What was that transition like? What is the difference? I mean, we all look alike to them anyway. So
right. You know what's interesting? I mean, at my time in the Black Panther Party, we were definitely a Marxist Leninist, very much influenced by the Maoist teachings, and even Kim Il Sung's Juche, you know, and it was reflected in how we organized and how we related to the world. But what was interesting when I look back on my own life is that on the ground level, on the rank and file level, there was much more of at least in my experience, an anarchistic way of dealing with things, because we dealt with things collectively on the ground level, from political education to how we organize people, even though, like, you know, the direction always came from the top. But why that stuck with me was that during my time in prison, when I began to read more anti-authoritarian material and anarchist material, what I found important to focus on was what was going on the ground level, you know, that we really didn't need to have a hierarchy, that we were thinkers ourselves, that we were learning ourselves, learning how to analyze, how to put theory into practice, and all of that stuff. So when I began to read about other revolutionary struggles, like the Spanish Civil War or Kropotkin's struggles, or what's the Ukraine, Makhno, and all of them. I'm like, well, listen, this possible then that even from this Panther experience, we can figure out a way to conduct it in a more anarchistic way. Now, then you come to find out that Kwesi Balogun was already there. He was already on that path, and Martin Sostre even before him. You know, so I find out that even comrades closer to me were not necessarily beholden to the Black Panther Party, more Marxist-Leninist, you know, more authoritarian line. So for me, I saw my growth moving in that direction, and then to find out there was a few others, not necessarily a lot, you know, of my peers, my comrades. But it was definitely good to see when I came out that there was a growing anarchist movement. And I had folks in the Black community, the Black and Latino community, who were very much interested in anarchist ideas. So that's one of the reasons why I did the Anarchist Panther zine, because I wanted to put my stuff out there and then to see who was receptive to it, where did it resonate, who liked it, and to find out that there was a whole bunch of folks and other zines out there that were reflecting the same things.
Ashanti, I found a quote that I wanted to read to you and just get your thoughts on. This is a quote from you from, looks like a book, Beyond Nationalism, But Not Without It.
Right.
Every time I hear someone talk about my people as if we were just some, quote, working class or, quote, proletariat, I want to get as far away from that person or group as possible, anarchist, Marxist, whatever. Can you talk about that a little bit? What did that mean to you?
Yeah, it's you know, because basically what I found that, like, my experience with Marxist-Leninist groups in the United States was that they could only see people in the framework of workers, you know. And, like, for me, it was just so dismissive of my experience or my people or, like, indigenous people or the Latino cultures and stuff, you know. And it's like, why do we all have to be workers? You know, there was just something racist about it. I did find it also in some anarchist circles, but not in all of them. And this was also around the time of Love and Rage. So Love and Rage, you know, was really open to learning about the liberation struggles within the United States and around the world. So it let me know that, you know, not all of the anarchists was around there, but identity struggles, if we want to call them that, are very important to understand that Black people's struggles here in the United States have a 500-year history. And, like, if we're going to conduct a struggle today for our liberation, you know, you just can't erase who we are. You know, you got to look at what has happened to us as a people who came from many different nations, in a sense, along the west coast of Africa, but through that whole Middle Passage and then the several hundred years of slavery, we had all of that practically wiped out, you know. So now in our struggle to be free here, we just can't, like, fight like we're workers. We are struggling for a certain kind of identity that gives us a certain self-esteem and pride to say, like, we're fighting because we are Africans in America. We came from a place that people didn't want us to know, and they made it the most negative, disgusting thing in the world, but we turned that around in the 60s with Black is Beautiful, Black Power. Groups have to understand that our struggle, the Black liberation struggle, is a legitimate struggle. We have workers. We have intellectuals. There's a few folks that got monies and stuff. We ain't even got a real Black bourgeoisie. But that struggle is still a struggle that has to go on. I don't want to be included in something that's asking me to erase who I am or who my people are. You know, that's why I like the Zapatista approach in terms of a world where many worlds exist. You know, that becomes very important to me. So it doesn't matter to me who it is. See me. This is who I am. Don't see me as just someone with tools in my hand, quite frankly, I haven't been that worker much of my life. I've been more of a lumpin', you know. So, but see me for who I am and who my people are and our history of struggle, because all of it actually ties in together.
When I first got into real radical politics, not just a base understanding that the government is evil and that war is bad, but really dissecting the ideas, the one that they struck home with me, of course, was the IWW and the workers' struggle.
Right.
I think because I grew up in a home full of workers, and I was always thought that you had to be a worker, and I looked around, I saw these workers, and then I started dissecting that later and found that the workers' struggle seems to me to be the slaves organizing on the plantation to take over the plantation and then stay on the plantation.
Uh-huh.
And it just didn't make much sense to me. It's like, well, wait a minute. I don't want to work a 9-to-5. I don't want to pay rent on this fucking apartment. I don't, I don't want those things. I want possibilities.
Right, right.
So, yeah, that definitely hits a certain key there when you talk about I don't want to see us as workers or whatnot.
Right, and even on that point you just made, because, and this is even part of me reading, other different anarchist theories and stuff. The whole thing about challenging workers is just like what you're saying. It's like, do we always want to be workers? Do we always want to have an industrial society? Will we ever question industrialism itself or civilization itself? So even those things there, it helps me at least to think differently about what our goals are down the line, but how we operate right now in terms of the relationships that we're trying to build with each other right now. I don't want to, IWW, I think, was a great experiment, but I don't want also a society where we're always going to have workers. We're always going to have a plantation. It ain't always been that way, but it does help one to see how their struggle needs to conduct itself in terms of not just carrying on old traditions that say, well, this is how Marx and them laid it down, the history of class struggle, the evolution of society from primitive communism through feudalism to capitalism, and then, on to the higher stages. All of that stuff, that's some formula that is actually never worked. But one of the reasons it hasn't worked because it has never dealt with people as who they are, but it's been the intellectuals' formulations of how they think people are supposed to be.
I'd like to address a couple things. Recuperation, where the state moves in and takes over movements, and civilization does this even more so than the state, puts them to their, we have the green economy and all this.
Oh yeah.
Talk about that a little bit, but I also want you. I want to hear about, and I want you to tell our listeners about, the teenage Ashanti before you were Ashanti, and when you went into your first Black Panther meeting and you were ready for your gun, and talk about that.
Oh,
that's a great story. I want to hear that story. What gun did they give you?
Oh my God! It's funny because I'm also for AK Press. I'm supposed to be working on my memoirs and stuff. Which I really got to get back to, but it really is. I like the story myself because I heard others of my comrades from the Panther Party relate similar stories. Because here we are, we're teenagers. We are very much want to get involved with this revolution. We see the fighting from the civil rights groups to the more radical Black Power groups and the radical aspects of the anti-war movement. And so for me and me and my best friend, Jihad, who was David at the time, when we see this picture of the Black Panther Party on this magazine, we want to find out about this group. And so with the help of David's father, we find chapters and we go to them and stuff like that. We get the papers. But when it gets to the point where, we say we want to join and they feel like we're ready, yeah, we want them guns. We want that uniform, the Black Parade. It was like really attractive. It's like the Black Parade, the light blue, powder blue shirt, the leather jacket, down to the boots. But when you see Huey with that shotgun, or Bobby Seale with that 9mm on his hip, like, whoa, we gonna get that too. But when we had that first serious meeting, what they told us was, you're going to get your weapons, and here they are, right? And what they put before us was a pile of books, you know. And them piles of books include everything from Mao Zedong, quotations of Mao Zedong, the Little Red Book, to the Communist Manifesto, but also like W.B. Du Bois' book on black Reconstruction and Frantz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth. And I'm like, whoa, I wasn't even a reader. But it was really great in the sense that they connected weapons. The first weapons you get was to raising your consciousness, raising your intellectual ability to understand what this situation was. Shortly later, we would still be introduced to the weapons, because they wanted us to understand that this weapon was not to be used or looked at in a loose, irresponsible way, but that it was also a tool of liberation. So we had to learn how to use weapons in the sense of how they operated, how to break them down, how to put them back together again, but the purpose was to defend the community, to defend the office, and to understand that the gun was a tool of the revolution and was never to become the leader of the revolution, you know. So that experience always stuck with me, and it just always made me laugh in a sense when I hear my other comrades relate similar things, because a lot of us felt like we wanted to be part of an army of revolutionaries, you know, but we had to challenge ourselves in terms of understanding what that meant, what that entailed.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we talk about a lot on the show, we debate endlessly is the power of ideas and, you know, whether they're a means to an end or the end in and of themselves. What ways are you impressed by, or if at all, the way that knowledge is being shared and accrued now in the digital age? And what ways do you think that can help, with the ongoing resistance here and around the world?
Well, it's definitely, I guess, because of this digital internet age, is definitely much more information, knowledge available. And I definitely think it's been very helpful. I tell people that I think that you who are younger than me, maybe of a younger generation than me, you understand a lot more than we did. When we start talking about the interconnections of different oppressions or the more complex analysis that allows us to see just what this neoliberalism is or how empire functions today rather than in the 60s. I mean, we didn't have a lot of that then, and it is a result of a lot more knowledge production out here from not only the academics but from, you know, people that's been really doing the groundwork, who have been not only working but writing about it or speaking about it or in conversations with others, where you can get that kind of creative argument going where new ideas or new thinkings can come about. But the one difference I still think that I see is that with what we did understand back then, we was more willing to take risks and putting it into practice, because we believe that, you know, practice is the thing that's going to tell you what's going to work. We say practice is the criterion of truth, you know, and Mao would say a fall in the pit is a gain in the wit. So you wouldn't be afraid to make mistakes, but you understood that from what you did with this information, you would learn what worked, what didn't, or what you might have to tweak, or what you might have to stretch, or what you may have to even let go of and search for some other lens to look at your situation to be able to move forward. I love being around the younger activist revolutionaries today, because when I hear them break down what's going on, it's fantastic. I learn, but that risk factor is not there, because I think people are still really afraid of the violence of the state. Just knowing what the state will do, you know, and even right now what they're doing with the Green Scare and all of that, and the continuing of repression in black and brown communities, people are really intimidated, even though they understand a lot more. That is the barrier that I see. That's a big one right now that we have not figured out how to go through.
Do you think that you, the Black Liberation Army, paved the way for that understanding of the brute end of the state? I mean, you expected the violence to come back from the state, I'm assuming.
Right, right. We did. We did, and let me tell you, we did, and then there was still an element of naivety in there. I mean, we knew it was coming, and we tasted it, but it was really, really vicious, you know, and really extensive, and not only because of like the guns, the way that they came after us with the guns was one thing, but with the use of the medias to help project this image of how they could crush opposition. And the impact that that had on our communities, from our families to our neighbors to broader communities, was really great. They knew what they were doing. And when we found ourselves isolated, it was really hard, you know. Groups have to really understand that today. They're going to do all of that, but we can still figure out ways to, like, overcome their attacks on us. You know what they're going to do. But, I mean, we've been really good even today from even this radio station that you're doing. You know, people are doing things like this. People are putting out zines. People are doing a guerrilla theater. There's all other kind of ways that we can communicate information. And I see it, which is why, you know, like, I stay optimistic because whatever the system comes up with, you know, we're finding ways to get around, and sometimes it's using their own technologies, you know, whether it's the internet, you know, or them cell phones. You know, we have to continually figure out how to be moving forward, whether they knock down what we do, whether they take what we got like you did. Now they can take the image of Che Guevara and commercialize it and commodify it and now sell it back to us and just take out the spirit of it. Same thing with Martin Luther King, but we have to still figure out how to move forward, how to be able to project practices, revolutionary images that inspire, whether we call that back then, we called it armed propaganda, you know, but we still have to figure out ways of getting to people to let people know there is another way, and that hope, it's good to hope. It's good to feel a sense of a sense that it's not doom, that these people can be conquered, but it has to start with us letting go of the thinking that they're so overwhelming and so all-powerful that there's nothing we can do. We have to show them. And I think that our circles in this movement, the more anti-authoritarian circles in the movement, have been good at it, but we got to do a lot better.
Well, that's kind of the motherfucker of it, though, isn't it? Like, when if the Black Liberation Army had Twitter, they might have done a little better. But now that there's Twitter, we don't have a Black Liberation Army. You know, we got this information, and we were talking about this in the last hour about the responsibility of information, and it seems now that people in the information age tend to think that information is the weapon, and it's like, well, no, information is the tool, but you are the weapon.
Right.
You are the weapon.
Right.
Yeah. Hammer until you put it in the hands of the slave owner, right? I mean.
Right, right. The section that you had on just before I came on, you know, it's like, I mean, for people to, like, take that serious, like, the way that this system controls us is so different that we cannot fight them with age-old techniques of revolutionary struggle that's been laid down in the last 100 years. We have continually have to come up with creative ways of challenging what they do. I mean, if the Black Liberation Army did know a lot of stuff that is out here now, yeah, maybe we could have survived, you know. But hey, that was the time. It didn't happen, but now there's the lessons, you know, that people can look at and see, okay, what did we do that people can learn from? What did we do that people don't want to learn from? What was our weaknesses? What were our challenges? you know, because I'm one who always believed that, and Asada says this too, that until black people are free, we're always going to need a black liberation army. And you figure, just like in Portland and Houston, I just came back from Buffalo, New York, with the way that the police are behaving in our communities, people should not be surprised if one day another black liberation army arises out of the black community, you know, or Puerto Rican underground Puerto Rican independence movement comes out of the Puerto Rican communities, because these police are in our communities not only like occupying armies, but they are part of occupying armies. And they are really, really on their job of keeping a heavy blanket of fear and intimidation throughout our communities. And it's only sometimes when the guerrilla comes forth to break through that, that people can see there's a way out. And I'm going to expand the use of the term guerrilla, because you need your guerrilla poets, you need your guerrilla artists, as well as those other traditional guerrillas out there who will begin to challenge this system and get away and disappear, you know, so that people can see that, yes, we can fight back. We can fight back. You know, because some of the ways we fought back in that time of the BLA and the Weather Underground showed that we can win. We wasn't trying to win the revolution. We was really just trying to keep people inspired by our actions, you know, and at a certain level we did, you know. But and I'm all right with saying that the system at some point crushed us. I'm never all right with saying we give up and never try it again. We got to go back to the drawing board and figure out how to do it much differently. And I would love to see it being done not only in a much more anti-authoritarian manner, but in a manner that doesn't also reproduce the sexisms and other tendencies that we do that shuts down our activities from within. And the new COINTELPRO programs just feed on that and ensure that we're going to fail. We have to win. We have to show people we can win.
G20.
Yeah, sorry. So, Ashanti, I wanted to ask you, well, first what you made me think of was been a string along in Gulf Coast cities, there's been a string of vandalism taking place against BP gas stations. And I was reading one discussion, and someone said, how does that stop BP? And one anarchist responded with, well, it's a symbolic act that shows that you can fight and you can get away with it too.
Right.
And it's the first thing that I thought of in terms, and you know, I'm have mixed feelings about, you know, people reacting when disaster hits, but you know, sometimes that's what it takes to put a fire under our ass. But one of the things I wanted to ask you about was, I'm just really curious as to what it was like for you in the 70s and 80s in the Black Liberation Army. I mean, was it just like, in what ways was it different from your time as a Black Panther? What did you learn in that regard? Was it, similar? How different was it? It was a different time, I'm assuming. And, what was that like for you?
Well, I mean, once you go underground, man, you're on a whole different, it's a whole different reality. Because it's being a Panther was already putting your life in danger, but you had a certain level of safety, I guess. I don't even know if that's the right word, because you're in the community as a Panther. You're working, you're organizing, you're meeting with people, you're traveling around trying to hook up with different organizations, different movements. And you have that kind of space to do it. Once you go underground, you have now entered into, I don't know how many more times, dangerous situation, because now you have not only entered the ranks of those who are going to actually defend the community, attack the enemy, but you know that they are going to put all kind of resources into getting you. And you know that when they come, they are coming, and they're not necessarily coming to capture you, you know. So the decision to go under was like there's a lot of paranoia, but on a certain level, you've got to turn the paranoia into something healthy so that you can stay aware at the same time that you still have to figure out how to connect with people, how to provide protection for organizations that are doing work, how to surveil, collect information for different other activities that you may do, whether it's against drug dealers, whether it's to raise funds for the revolutions in terms of them banks and other things like that, or whether it's to put a different kind of fear in them police forces that are really wicked in your community in terms of shooting, you know, the shootings and the intensified presence in your community. I mean, the Black Liberation Army also, you know, when there was such a rash of police killing our youth, the Black Liberation Army went after them police, especially in the New York, New Jersey area, you know. And those type of things there, I mean, even for me, it was like you are on the move constantly. You're always looking around, looking over your shoulder, looking at people's faces, but you know that your mission is to just survive. You got to survive by continually connecting with folks, folks that you knew would give you support. Sometimes you find folks from unexpected quarters that are supporting you, you know, but it's your ability to keep moving without getting caught, to be able to stay out there long enough to help an underground movement build to the point where they couldn't crush it. And we couldn't hold it, and we didn't hold it. And a lot of times our experiences underground were really short, you know, but it gave us, we learned enough under to figure out how we could have done it better, but sometimes that was from the position of being in prison, you know, that sometimes the paranoia got great. Sometimes the mistakes we made were really stupid. And sometimes the gun did begin to take too much of a leadership role. Those things did happen, you know. But even the unit that I was in, you know, we learned from those in our unit who were Vietnam veterans. We learned from those in our unit who was like hustlers and stick-up kids in the community. We learned how to carry out operations from the collective knowledge of our unit, you know, and we was also in the process of connecting up with other BLA units who were doing the same thing, even though it was always a need-to-know basis, you know, but the whole purpose was to grow. We needed to grow to become a formidable force for the struggles that we were involved with, that we were not going to be the leadership. And even though at some point I think that changed too, and that was probably a down point too, where we felt like the guerrilla movements could actually lead, you know. But we made mistakes, but I think that we were out there long enough to show that an underground movement connected to our struggles, our local struggles, could survive, you know, but we never got a second chance for real to see if we could do it.
One of the things that we discuss a lot on the show is violence, and you know, whether in resistance violence can or should be appropriate anymore, or whether or not it's something that we should try and move beyond. What are some of your viewpoints on you know, kind of the hierarchical violence system we have, top-down violence versus bottom-up violence, and whether or not it's appropriate, and, you know, what's your take on that?
Well, I you know, it's like it's always, you know, you come to the question of violence. The first thing that one should deal with the question of violence is the violence of the state, you know, that none of us who are of the oppressed make our first choice weapons, or the instrument, the various instruments of violence, is when the state, the government, corporations, or even reactionary communities drive us to that point where we don't have an alternative, you know. I, for one, believe that, you know, when when you're dealing with empire, you have got to accept that it ain't going nowhere peacefully. It ain't going nowhere through moral argument, through rationalisms or whatever. You know, you get them off your back, you know, by any means necessary, as Malcolm says, right? And that by any means necessary is whatever works to free you, you should be preparing yourself to do. And after like a 400-year period of black people just dealing with the black liberation struggle, being in this country, you know, like there were those of us of the more revolutionary elements who had already come to the conclusion that, listen, we need to gear up now. There should always be preparations made for an underground because we know how this system is going to come at us. You know, we're not going to be free without the gun. You know, and I think it's just like the Zapatistas. Like, and then we can talk about, you know, maybe the gun this time not so much in the hierarchical manner. Maybe it has to be in a more anti-authoritarian manner. Maybe we really need to look at how other more anti-authoritarian struggles have dealt with it and see what we can learn from it. I think the Zapatistas also have a lot to offer. But I know that we're not going to be free in this country, not just even black people in this sense, but nobody, if we don't fully accept and embrace the eventuality of bringing this system to its knees and doing it in whatever manner it's going to take that also allows us to remain human. So Assad al-Shakur would not be in Cuba today if it was not for the Revolutionary Task Force, which was the Black Liberation Army and Weather Underground elements, going into that prison to get her. There was many programs in the community that would not have had the money to function if it wasn't for the expropriations of the Black Liberation Army, hitting them banks and armored cars, in many cases hitting dope dealers too, and funneling the monies into programs. I just think it's about being very, very realistic about what we're up against. We cannot be naive about this. You cannot be, and especially when, you know, when the state does catch up with you like they did with Twyman Myers in the Bronx back in 73. When they caught up with Twyman Myers, a soldier of the Black Liberation Army, they didn't give him a chance to pull out his gun on the street. They mowed him down. You're talking about 41 bullets with the Amadou Diallos and the others. They mowed him down. They shot him so much that they left one of his legs dangling by his tendons, you know, because they wanted us dead, you know. You got to accept that. It's not a nice picture, but life, if we want to live, and if we want to live free with dignity, we got to accept the eventuality that we're going to be fighting these people with everything we got. We got to figure out how to do it and stay human and stay loving, but we got to do it, you know, because every day they are killing us, whether it is the physical death of the body or whether it is social death. They're killing us. So, I mean, people need to face it. I know it's a hard thing to do, but, you know, for me, because, you know, I have seen how they react at the end of the gun, you know, it tells me that, you know, they are not invincible, you know. Because when we did certain actions that even if the tombs thing, we were trying to break out some of the political prisoners, when we pulled out our guns and took the guards and locked them up in the bathroom, we wanted to demonstrate to people that even the agents of the state can be overcome, can be overtaken, and made to follow the will of the guerrilla. And in this sense, you know, the guerrilla is also a part of the people, you know, and the people got to really accept that. If we're going to be free, you know, we have to, like, really develop the attitude that this is ours, and we not only have a right, you know, to it, we have to do it because it is just part of human. We want a life where we are governing our own affairs without anybody in a position to oppress us, kill us, murder us, cause us untold misery, us and all people around the world. We have got to face it. There's no other way around it.
you touched briefly on the liberation of the prisoners, which is something I want to talk about, prisoner support, and you know, I've always said that if the Animal Liberation Front really wants to be a full-on revolutionary force beyond just liberating animals in cages, they need to be liberating prisoners and human animals from real prisons. We need to move on to start liberating people from the prisons on a regular basis.
Right.
You have a great story you tell, and I hate to break it down to sound like a fucking anecdote because it's not an anecdote. It's a real tale. It's a real story. About attempting to free some comrades from a prison cell, and you know, not having the proper know-how for the use of the tools.
That is basically the one I was just referring to. I mean, no, really, and it's part of how, like, in the Panther Party, you learn, like, use what you got to get what you need. You know, so you start with what you got. And that whole thing was what I was talking about, the tombs. There was three Black Liberation Army, more than actually three. There's probably about five Black Liberation Army soldiers in the Manhattan House of Detention at this time, and three of them were facing the death penalty out in California. So this was when I actually got recruited into the Black Liberation Army for the specific mission of getting them out of the tombs before they got sent back to California to face the death penalty and stuff. And so we're working day and night to pull this thing off. The first attempt was, we had information that from the political prisoners that there was a tunnel near the Manhattan House of Detention that led right up under the jail. And if we could get there, we could get up under, come from under the jail and bring them out. But of course, that if we went and found the tunnel, that they was the manhole cover, but there was a wall blocking the entrance. And we got in, and it was wee hours in the morning, and some John Q. citizen saw, you know, several Black folks in this area where we wasn't supposed to be, and we got arrested. We was in the island, Rikers Island, for a few days. They let us go. They could only charge us with tampering with a manhole cover. But the newspaper account said that they thought that we was trying to get into the building right outside of the manhole cover, which was a city government building that housed all the plans of every prison in New York. And when we read that in the newspaper, it was like, well, man, if we had known that, that would have been our objective. You know, that would have been help with us not only getting them out of that prison, but to have plans to all the prisons would have been great. But it didn't happen. So we're back to the drawing board. So the next thing is we're going to get them out of the visiting room. And the visiting room was it's like a metal wall with a glass window and a telephone, and that's how you visit them. You know, and we knew that we had to cut a hole in this metal wall to get them out. And I wasn't supposed to be the one to do it, but the person who we wanted to do it was a guerrilla somewhere else, and he just couldn't. He had other responsibilities. He couldn't do it at the time, but we wanted to move ahead and do it. So I had to give myself a crash course and how to use an acetylene torch. So we got acetylene torch, and we're at certain places. I'm doing certain things to figure out how to work it, and I think I got it down. So the day that we go to visit the political prisoners, we was able to, like, take them food every day because they was on trial. So after the trial, we go to the jail. We give them food. We pass a bag to the guards. The guards would go through the food and then give it to the political prisoners. But on this particular day, you know, we set the bag down on the table, and when we opened the bag up, though, we didn't pull out food. We pulled out the weapons. And when we pulled out the weapons is when we took the guards and we locked them up in the bathroom. We proceeded to the floor that the visitors was on. And there was other visitors up there, too, you know. And the thing is, you know, like, New York is like, hey, New Yorkers are really cool. You know, they see us pulling stuff out the bag. Here I am with the acetylene torch, and folks got guns, you know, but they're just going on with their visits. The political prisoners behind the wall had took care of the guards on their side. So here I am cutting. And I'm cutting, and it's like, I would imagine about 2 feet by 2 feet by 2 feet, you know, like that type of, but I had 2 inches to go, and the oxygen tank ran out. And when the oxygen tank ran out, I couldn't cut anymore. But the metal was so hot in other places that it dripped, and sometimes it kind of reseals it, so we couldn't kick it. One of the sisters in the unit wanted to shoot it, but that would just alert, you know, everybody. So we had to look at the political prisoners and, like, make a decision right there. It's like, we got to go, you know. And the decision to go was real hurtful because two of the sisters in the unit, it was also not only their comrades behind the walls, but it was their partners, you know. And so it was like telling them, like, listen, you know, you're not coming out, but we got to get out of here, you know. So it was the black power fist, power to the people, and we're out of there. And as easy as it was for us to plan and do this going in, we had it planned to get out in our van or, you know, what we used to get away, and we were out of there and out of the state. If we had been successful, we'd have had 5 Black Liberation Army soldiers, and I'm sure that some of them other prisoners who were on their visits would have came with us. But part of it was to let people know that it could be done, because if you could see the Manhattan House of Detention, if you could see the area that it's in, it is nothing but concrete steel structures. It's the city court, state court, federal court, the Manhattan jail, and nothing but police. And because of their arrogance of power, they would never assume that the guerrillas would come into their midst and do something like that. But it was part of what we saw also as armed propaganda. We have got to show that this system is vulnerable, that it is not invincible, and that the people can overcome, the people can be victorious. So even we didn't get them out, the victory was in that we was able to get away and continue to fight, you know. And that we did, you know, until a little further down the line, you know, during the bank expropriation in New Haven, Connecticut, 3 of us were captured. But the guerrillas, you know, the purpose of the guerrilla even then, and I think it's the same with the Animal Earth First movements, is to show that we can win. We can attack. We can disrupt. We can show that it is possible for people to fight back to the point where we can shut this system down, destroy it, and create something different, you know. And those examples, like, for me, is like, and it's one of the things that I, you know, I am writing about in this book. One is I can write about it because the statute of limitations ran out, so they can't try me for it. But the other part is that I want people to know what the activities of the underground were, so that they don't just think it was just speaking, you know, the great speakers or some of the organizers, but they need to know also some of us who took to illegality, who took to political illegalism to, like, be a part of aiding the community work, the interconnections with different movements, the visioning processes that were going on that was trying to get us to, like, envision what the United States or America would look like if it was a total revolution in connection with all the other revolutions and struggles that was going on in the world. It was still, you know, a time of excitement and hope too, you know. But shortly after that, a lot of us was in prison, you know. But for me, it's not over. You know, we just got to learn.
You know, I think that's obviously it's one of the most vicious tools and thievery, bits of thievery they have against us is they've stolen our history, you know, they rewrite it. They give us the Gandhis. They give us the MLKs.
Hey, right.
They give us the John Browns. They don't give us the Nat Turners. They don't give us the Harriet Tubmans.
No.
And, And so I think that's great. But, you know, you left out probably my favorite part of that story. You glazed over. You said that you locked him in the bathroom. But tell us where you locked the guards. Tell us. I want to hear it.
Well, when we pulled out our guns and took them, like, well, we had to put them somewhere, one. And there was the bathroom, right? And I know that our whole thing was not only we putting them in there, but you know how you got the toilet and you got the pipe there. We're going to use their own handcuffs and handcuff them right to the toilet, you know, because we want them to know that's what we think of the job that they do, you know. So you be next to that shitty toilet because that job you do is shitty, you know. And that's what we did. You know, and I mean, like I think it was a part, maybe it was a part of the humor of us too, but we wanted to prove a point, you know, that you got to look at what you, because I think at least two of them, maybe all three of them was of color and black, you know, and they got to see what they do. You cannot just can't be a job. You just can't say, I was just doing my job, you know, you need to look at it. You know, so, and that's exactly what we did. We handcuffed them to the toilets, and we proceeded to that floor and went to work. I hope I tell it better in the book.
Well, you know, it's funny that I asked you to repeat that story, because I already posted up online the last talk that you gave where you eloquently told the story hilariously. But it's one of my favorite damn things to hear. I mean, it's, you know, we don't have many victories, as far as I know, in the history of the resistance recently. But, you know, the small things that really count. It really is. Like, right. You know, you go to these huge actions and 300 of your comrades get taken down and, you know, taken to the jail at an action. But, you know, you got to celebrate the one cop car that got burned. You know, you got to celebrate those victories.
Right. You have to. You have
And hooking those pigs up to the toilet, that's a victory, you know.
And it's not over. We have got to win, man. I mean, it's like, I think for me, I don't want people to think that, you know, that 60s period or the early 70s period was something that is just relegated to history now. You know, we're still here, and that and those small victories like that are still here, you know, and they're here for people to take and use, you know. But I mean, like, when you're talking about the underground, I mean, the importance of it is that, you know, you get to see what this system will really do, but you also get to understand why it is important that we think underground, why we think illegal, why we do not get caught up into, you know, we got to stay within the boundaries of legalities, you know, or reason and stuff like that. No, man, no, that's not how we're going to be free, you know. So sometimes Martin Luther King said, you know, we got to break the law when the law is unjust. But, you know, as an anarchist, I'm like, all of them is unjust, you know. So you got to use their laws when it's in your favor. You got to break them when it's in your favor, you know. But you got to think we can win. You got to be convinced we can win. I don't care how bad it looks, we can win.
But
you know,
don't fight like you already won, because that's the problem. People think they already won. But, Ashanti, we're at the end of our rope here tonight, and the show is going to shut off in a minute on us. So I want to say thanks so much for coming on tonight, and I want you to tell the people about a website where they can find you, Jericho Project, any of that stuff.
Yeah, definitely, man. Support the political prisoners, everybody. Jericho Movement, I'm going to give you the P.O. Box and the website number. The P.O. Box is 1272 New York, New York, 10013. You can go to the website, www.thejerichomovement.com, you know, and you can find out all the information on all these political prisoners here. Support them, visit them, work with us in whatever ways you can to help to free them. Marilyn Buck hopefully will be coming home in August, hopefully. But we're crossing our fingers, because when Veronica Bowers was due to come home 4 years ago, Attorney General Gonzalez at the time made a personal call to the warden and told the warden not to release him because he was a terrorist, even though he finished his time and the warden had him prepared to leave and his family was in the parking lot waiting. So it's a struggle, and we don't change that until we are able to organize in such ways that we can deliver political consequence when they don't follow the will of the people. So I'm still about the Panther. I'm still about power to the people, power through the people. So I'm encouraging people, let's get involved, but never forget the political prisoners.
Absolutely. Josh, man, thanks so much.
Right on. And thanks for this opportunity.
Thank you very much for doing the show.
I don't know if you know that there's two of us on here.
I do.
Okay. just so you don't think that one guy has a really weird split personality, you know.
I like your.
Well, thanks again for joining us, Ashanti, and thanks everyone so much for listening. Have a great week. Who do we have next week, Rabble Rouser?
Next week we have Wati Yatawin. She's one of the most badass indigenous resistance fighters out there. She's amazing, and she's going to be joining us next week. So hear about the indigenous resistance. We'll be dancing with the resistance next week, the title that she really laughed at. But, Ashanti, you want to close us out with the power to the people?
That's right, man. And also, being actually talking about dancing, Emma Goldman said, you know, if you can't dance in this revolution, don't want to be a part of it. But remember, it is all power through the people, through the people. That's where it's at. So, Hardy, all power through the people to all the listening audience.
All power through the people, man. Thanks for joining us.
Right on.
All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us on Burn this week. Go rob a bank.
Yep, take it easy.
Oh, right on.
But
good night.
Okay.
All right.